You're listening to Generational Warfare, where millennials and Zers come together to explore what it'll take to be different than generations past. I'm Rye the Y. I am joined, as usual, by Ezekiel the Z. And we have a special guest this week, Luke Baumgarten, who is the founder of Range Media. And we're so excited to have him on to talk about the reporting that he's been doing, but also to talk about Range itself and what it's providing for our community here. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. So I'd love to start with your story. So kind of you pre-Range, what was kind of your, what did your career look like before this? And are you a native Spokaneite? What was kind of your geographic story as well?
Yeah, I grew up around here. I was raised in Chatteroy, north of Meade. I basically spent my entire life in Spokane. I went to Gonzaga. The two years I spent outside of the county where I got to study abroad in Italy for a year as an undergrad, and then I lived in Seattle, as basically everybody did in the early aughts. I graduated from college in 2003, left Spokane, made a pilgrimage to Seattle. About half my friends moved to Seattle, the other half moved to Portland, as one did back in those days. But other than that, yeah, I moved back to Spokane to either try to go to grad school or get a job as a writer. Like, I didn't even think of myself as a journalist back then. I didn't study journalism in college. I got a job, freelancing at first, but then pretty quickly a job at the Inlander in about, I think, like late 2004. Time's a flat circle. I think 2000, early 2005-ish maybe. And then I was there for 7 years until late 2012. And in that process, my career has been really, really strange. So, you know, starting off music editor, arts editor at the Inlander, by kind of the end of my term, or not quite the end of my term, but eventually was responsible for about half the paper every week. It was about 32 pages of content. Oh, wow. And then for the last, well, half of those are ads, so let's say 16 pages. Just I don't want to puff myself up too much. But then I just went back to being a writer because fundamentally that's what I loved doing. And I was kind of, it's so much of traditional media, and I'm not even singling out the Inlander here. I'm just talking about media outlets that were built in a time of abundance and then lived through a period, the current period we're in, of scarcity. I would say a disproportionate amount of that that delta is made up with the passion of writers who work for criminally low wages. Mm. And that creates all sorts of really, I would say, negative incentives for the journalism industry, and I think really, really negative outcomes for communities like ours, where it's, we're not San Francisco, we're not New York, we're not Chicago, we're not, you know, the really big, we're not like the major leagues in terms of, you know, the top rung of where you can get as a journalist. And so you end up being, that allows for lots of things like, you know, people coming through for a couple of years to build their resume and then moving on somewhere else. And one of, I'm already getting into my spiel here and I'm just supposed to be talking about my biography, but the more that I've done this work, and as, especially as I get older and have a sense of like really understanding what it is the work is, the two most important things are doing journalism enough, long enough that you know how to get good at it as a profession, and being in a place long enough that you know the place well enough to be able to report well about it. And those are two completely different things. And so until we can create livable, like career wage, family wage jobs for journalists in places like Spokane, there's always going to be a journalism crisis in my mind, even if the business model gets fixed. In terms of meaning like the profit holders, the shareholders, the people who are actually making money off of journalism.
Right.
If the business model gets fixed, but it doesn't trickle down to the people actually doing the work, then that's, the journalism crisis is going to continue. Left the Inlander, kind of did the only thing that a guy who's spent the first decade of his career writing could really do and make more money than a journalist, which was advertising. And while I was, this is where my career is like a little bit bifurcated, because the job that, like, the work that I was doing that was paying my bills, I was also helping start a nonprofit called Terrain, which is an arts organization in Spokane. I did that when I was 27, when we started Terrain. So that was kind of in the middle of my time at the Inlander. And then after I left the Inlander and went into advertising and had a lot more time on my hands, I started a co-working space called Fellow Co-working. And then I realized the advertising job I had was doing like pretty cool work, but for national clients like Nickelodeon, Disney, AT&T. And I went from literally getting like yelled at and or praised, but more often yelled at in coffee shops for like my music writing or, you know, like my cultural writing, to never seeing the fruits of my labor at all. You know, when you're doing work for national clients. And I think I realized like then, partially through Terrain and part, like, I think a lot of my self-realization comes from looking backwards on like, oh, what did I actually love about that thing? Or why did I jump on board when somebody said, you want to start an arts organization, or do you want to just throw an art party, was the first thing that we sort of set out to do with Terrain. I think I realized how important community was to me like years after the fact. So left that advertising job where I was a worker, and then started an advertising agency of my own where I was a boss. And long story short, because I don't want to belabor this too much, like, I realized I didn't like either being a worker or being a boss in the traditional ways those things are thought of. And so started thinking about alternative ways of structuring companies, or just structuring organizations, or structuring people who are doing work together. And after, so then, you know, the advertising agency we started grew, it got pretty big. We do some cool things, and we turned ourselves into a B Corp first to make sure that we were sort of living our values of, you know, making sure people were pay equity and benefits and stuff. And then
remind me again how a B Corp works.
B Corps, like, it's not like, so like there's business structures like S Corps and C Corps, mm-hmm. that are like federal designations. A B Corp is actually more like a certification, like an organic certification. So you go through this process by a private nonprofit, and they have standards around like environmental stewardship, customer service stuff, worker, you know, equity stuff, racial equity stuff, diversity stuff. And then you basically get a certification. If you get 80 points on this arbitrary scale, you get to be a B Corp.
So you can be a for-profit company and still be a B Corp?
Most are. It's actually, okay. Can you be I don't even know if you can be a nonprofit and be a B Corp. It's
okay.
It was actually created as a way to, it's a pretty tough standard to meet. And so it was a way to, there was a bunch of greenwashing that was happening in corporate spaces. So the B Corp certification, I think, was originally a way of being like, in much the same way that like the organic certification was originally created. It was like, oh no, you can't just say that like we use, you know, pig crap instead of synthetic fertilizer, that means we're organic. It was like, no, we have to have standards around this thing. So that was the B Corp, and the B Corp's great. We're proud of the B Corp. That company is still pretty involved in the B Corp movement locally. We were like this third B Corp in Spokane, and now there's like nine of us. But then when the pandemic hit, I had been feeling like advertising can be, if you've got the right clients and if you're doing work on behalf of people who are doing meaningful work, it can be like by the transitive property, at least for somebody like me who likes making things, it can be a really meaningful thing. But it still didn't scratch the same itch that journalism scratched for me. And so I'd been thinking about trying to get back into journalism, and then the pandemic happened, and I had nothing but time on my hands to think about it. And so that's kind of how Range came about. It was April. Well, I mean, it started literally when the lockdown happened, but our first episode came out in mid-April. And it was like, you know, I'm not quite 40 at this point. I've done some things, started some things, and I have a finite amount of life left in me. And if this isn't a good enough excuse to get me to start a journalism thing, then maybe it's just not meant to be. And so that was kind of the bargain I made with myself. And so, but at the same time, though, my now partner, co-founder at Spokane Workers Co-op, Joel Williamson, who has done the Grain Shed and Link Foods and other, most of the co-op, the worker co-ops in Spokane, was kind of having similar thoughts about what his next project would be. And so that's where Range didn't become part of the Spokane Workers Co-op until last December or two Decembers ago, I guess, December 2021. But we started talking at almost the exact same time as I launched Range about this idea of sort of a holding company that's a worker-owned cooperative. So that buys, acquires, or starts up businesses, but that every single business that they buy or acquire becomes worker-owned just by the fact of being inside the holding company. And so those are the two big projects we've been working on since basically April of the dawn of COVID.
So I want to dig into how that shapes your coverage or what you feel like being a co-op allows you to do. But I think it would be valuable to first like get into the nitty-gritty of what that means to be a co-op. So from thinking kind of a financial perspective as well as a governance perspective, What does being a co-op mean? What does it mean for specifically Range to be a co-op and for it to be part of something, some like a bigger workers cooperative? What's the relationship between those?
Totally. Yeah. So basically, I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of co-ops. So we are a worker-owned cooperative, which means the people who do the work own the cooperative. Like REI is a consumer cooperative. That means the people that shop at REI are the owners of REI. Main Market Co-op is a consumer co-op as well. The idea behind co-ops in general, and I'm not like the co-op historian here, but like was getting the incentives of the market, the incentives of capitalism, as close to aligned with the needs of whoever you care most about, you know? So in my case, I think a lot about workers and what it was like to be one. Getting the incentives of capital as closely aligned to the incentives of the workers as we can get within the system we currently have, the parts of the system that we have no control over. Luckily, Washington State, I would say Washington and Colorado have two of the best regulatory frameworks or legal frameworks, state legislative frameworks for co-ops. So the idea that Joel had for a sort of cooperative of cooperatives, or a holding company cooperative, was taking a specific kind of co-op that was like, it's called a limited cooperative association, which is like a state designation of a company that allows you to be a worker-owned cooperative, but also bring on kind of traditional investors, but in such a way that you can structure it where the workers can never be outvoted by the investors. And it's not a straight like equity purchase the way that a lot of startup capital is, where it's not like I'm going to give you $1 million and you're going to give me 20% of the company. It's more like I'm going to give you however much money I give you. And rather than getting a fixed chunk of the company, you get a fixed return on that investment. So it's kind of, I know I'm not a bank guy, but it's kind of like interest on a savings account or something. So as long as you keep your money in there. So if it was say somebody gave $100,000 or, invested $100,000, in years when it's profitable, the co-op would give that person $5,000 back. Because we target a $5,000 return. And then all of the rest of the profit, if it exists, gets spread evenly among the workers who work at the various businesses. Mm. And that's split up based on share. So without getting too nerdy with the details, it's like if you're a full-time worker, you get one share. So if you're working 40 hours a week, you get one of however much, a fraction is going around. And if you're a 20-hour a week worker, you get one half. And so that's a way of people still have different salaries. But we try to structure that equitably as well. And then you made actually a really smart distinction that a lot of people don't even really think about. And I'm going to admit I wouldn't have thought about until, we were already in it. business structure is not the same as management structure. And so you can have a super hierarchical, super top-down co-op if that's the way you choose to structure it.
Yeah.
This is Joel's innovation here, or his, you know, he brought this to the table. This wasn't me. Use this thing called holacracy, which is a management structure that seeks to distribute decision-making as close to the problem or as close to the people solving the problems as possible. So range makes decisions about range, unless it's decisions that are going to impact the entire cooperative. And in larger teams, like at the grain shed over on Perry, they have that business is broken up into teams. They've got their bakery team. I think they've got a front of house team, and they've got a baker and a brewery team. And so it's like the bakery team only makes decisions about the bakery. The brewing team makes decisions about the brewery. The front of house team makes decisions about the front of house. And then when there are questions of mutual concern, they solve those together. So it's a structure that's sort of designed to invert hierarchy and really flatten structure as much as possible. To the extent that like the board of the Spokane Workers Co-op, we had to spend a lot of time figuring out what the board actually gets to do. And so, because most of the decision making lives with the individual companies and the individual people doing specific roles inside the companies. So,
so what does the board kind of pay attention to the most?
Right now we vote on, and really, and that's, this is more of a rubber stamp thing, because we set it like, you know, the other thing is like, you can set whatever term you want for people to be able to come from just basic employees to worker owners. So in some places that's a year within a, you know, like a year probationary period. And then you can have like an up to another year for the existing worker owners to be like, yeah, I want Ryan to actually be part of the club. We thought that also might create, or, and potentially does create, a, you know, a stratified sort of class within what's designed to be a kind of hierarchy free zone. So we shrunk it down to like 3 months, and then unless that person's like about to be fired, they pretty much get to be a worker owner. So the board doesn't actually deliberate over that decision. They hear from the individual companies that like, yeah, Ryan's doing a great job, that, and he's hit his 90 days, so he's a worker owner. Welcome to the club. The things that we have really big discretion over are forward-looking, like capital expenditures that would require taking on a bunch of new debt or new equity or something that the team couldn't do on its own, the individual business couldn't do on its own. And then we're putting in place some sort of protective mechanisms where it's like, okay, this, and again, this is really, it's hard to even talk about, not because I don't want to talk about it, but because like to sort of frame it in a way, 'cause it's so qualitatively different than the way most, you know, jobs are run. It's like, what's the point at which a business that from the outside looks like it's being like, oh, this could be run a little bit better, to like, oh, this is actually causing a problem for the whole organization, like figuring out, and this is still very much something we're trying to noodle through, but figuring out what action the board can take to sort of be like, no, this isn't actually working. We need to step in and be part of the team. 'Cause we also are trying not to strip autonomy ever entirely. And then there's also some other stuff, and this is not exactly a board role, but it's more of like an administrative team that lives inside the co-op. It's like, okay, so Treatment, the advertising agency, is part of the co-op now. So we have like a marketing team in the co-op. We have Range in the co-op. We have, you know, Great Harvest Bakery and Golden Handle Brewery in the co-op. We've got this really powerful marketing and advertising team. Can we just say, hey, we want to come help you sell more bread? Or do we have to be invited, say like, hey, we would like you to help us sell more bread, right? These are the conversations that get really... This is supposed to be about Range. It's turning into a co-op podcast. Like, these are the things, like, if you want to create something that's not just like a command and control structure, and there's a little bit of complexity in the system, these are questions that become really, really important, and then kind of life or death in some situations, you know? So, yeah, it's been a wild year So we did range for about 2 years until we were ready to, until the co-op was ready. So Range was actually the first business in the co-op. And then Range hired, and we wanted to do that before we hired our audience editor, Val, and she came on in January of last year, so 2022. And so, I mean, that was the only, I guess we can talk about how Range has evolved later, but it was just important to make sure that we had the co-op structure figured out, dialed, and before we brought somebody else in, so that we could say, like, yeah, you are a worker owner. It's not like somewhere off in the horizon. You own this thing from day 90, you know?
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation and hone back in on Range and its coverage in the area. Stick with us.
Tune into the Inbox every Sunday at 11 a.m. for a dive into a wide array of the best new music and independent releases of the past 2 years. My name is Hallie, and I invite you to join me for 2 hours of musical discoveries, new artists, and recent releases. Community input is always welcome, and we invite you to call in with your requests at 509-747-3807. That's The Inbox, Sundays at 11 a.m., only on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio.
Welcome back to Generational Warfare here on KYRS. We have Luke Baumgarten from Range Media, and we're discussing the coverage that they've been doing and the business of Range itself, and which is a key part of understanding what allows them to do coverage for our community differently, perhaps, than some other outlets have been able to do. And I want to hone in a little bit on that, how you think about Range as being distinct, what hole you felt like or what gap when you created Range, you felt like it was filling. Maybe I'll just say my understanding of the media environment in Spokane is that a lot of people have considered outlets like The Inlander and The Spokesman to be more resilient than a lot of other local news outlets elsewhere, while a lot of other kind of big newspapers have been getting gobbled up by private equity firms. The Spokesman is still very proud about the fact that it's locally owned. Yeah. And of course, we can talk about what that means exactly. But and The Inlander, also locally owned, is very proud of the fact that it's one of the few surviving alt-weeklies in the United States. So in the context of seemingly a fairly vibrant news environment in Spokane, how did you feel like, or what did you feel like needed to be done differently?
I mean, just as a brief aside, Spokane in a million different ways is one of the weirdest places in America. Ways that for media companies, it's really, really weird is that we're a mid-sized city that's not a bedroom community of any other larger urban agglomeration. We're one of the most isolated mid-sized cities in America, actually, outside of like Alaska, probably. And as a result of that, we're like the 94th largest city in America, but we're the 60th largest media market. We're actually bigger than Honolulu because, you know, let's talk TV stations mostly, because that's mostly what media markets are. The TV stations go all the way to the Cascades in a lot of cases. They go all the way into eastern Montana, in some cases down to northeastern Oregon, and, you know, public television goes all the way up into Calgary and Edmonton, right? So we're like, in some ways, we're an international media market, at least for certain things. And I think that's actually part of, I'm not an economist, but like that's part of what I think has made the media ecosystem here a lot more resilient. I think we catch on to technological trends 5 or 10 years later than other people, although that's the pace of that's probably closing together. But we aren't a city that those quote unquote disruptive tech things are really actively trying to disrupt. And we have this base that's pretty big for people who, you know, for viewers and listeners and stuff like that. So I think there's like this very material reality about Spokane that makes it qualitatively different than even Boise. Although I think Boise has a much more vibrant media market than like Tacoma, for example, thinking about cities that are roughly the same size as us. And part of that has also to do with cost of living, I'm sure. But when I was thinking about range, like I'm, to be honest, man, I was trying to find my voice again as a person. I thought there was something in, media that would like kind of like a fresh air type thing with little extra, you know, edge, which is just kind of who I was as a journalist when I was coming up, like long, thoughtful interviews with, you know, people doing good work. I knew from the beginning I wanted to sort of, I didn't necessarily want to be having nothing but interviews with like the mayor and the city council president and people like that, like finding underrepresented voices. But then pretty quickly the unrest around George Floyd happened, and that like hunch became like the whole reason for continuing, you know, because it seemed like, okay, the philosophy may, like, you know, I grew up relatively poor, and I feel incredibly lucky that I got to go to Gonzaga. It really helped shape who I am as a person in terms of the education I got there. But I also recognize, like, I got to live in Europe for a year, and I got to be a philosophy major, for God's sake, and that did not harm my career prospects as like the oldest possible millennial. Like the kids that came in as interns at the Inlander just a couple years, you know, by 2007, 2008, like I, both from like a timeline perspective, there's just a ton of privilege that has collided in me to like allow me to do the things I've been able to do in my life. And so having this like thoughtful discursive podcast in the wake of a pandemic and in the wake of, you know, the continual and persistent murder of people of color was just like, okay, cool. Like pull, how much am I allowed to swear? Like just pull your head out, dude. Like, and so that, yeah, and then the podcast got enough attention that some folks, another really interesting thing about Spokane is that even the people that don't work in journalism in Spokane anymore tend to move on to other things and have a kind of a fond feeling for Spokane, or they live in Spokane and they work for nonprofits that are doing cutting edge, you know, DEI work. And so I was able to, like, people found me, like these mentors, people that I'd lost track of when they left this media market, who were like, oh, I'm working for this nonprofit now, and Range is really interesting, and I'd love to, you should consider writing this grant, or you should consider going out for this boot camp. And really it was a process of that, where it was like by fall of that first year, I'd gotten accepted into a boot camp that was run by Lion Publishers, which is local independent online news publishers. It's basically a trade group for local, specifically local news startups. And that was funded by Facebook, one of the platforms that helped destroy journalism. And, or no, that one was funded by Google, which again, you know, like starting with Craigslist, like all the people that fund journalism philanthropically now are mostly the platforms that contributed to the, and I don't want to say they broke journalism. What they did was break the traditional business model, which we can talk about more. Mm-hmm. So like, it was like, got a little head nod from those people. And these are like people who spend all day, every day thinking about how to make journalism work at a local in places that aren't New York or San Francisco, or that don't have a national reach, right? Where it's like, oh, I'm going to spin up a niche publication looking at, you know, this perspective, but it's going to be a national publication. Like those are easier things to monetize than local news from a digital perspective. And so that helped shape like, oh wow, we really should try to do actual reporting. And then that next year, or within the next 6 months, there was another opportunity to write a grant for what became our audience editor's role, Val. And then it was like, okay, we have a person thinking about how to grow this thing. We have me, and I'm doing as much reporting as I can, but I'm only one person, and it's not the full thing I think about. So I just started asking people if they would give us grants to hire a reporter, which is how we got Carl. And meanwhile, we have our business model is entirely membership run. And I want to, because again, trying to like in a similar way to the co-op, marrying the incentives of the market to the incentives of the people who are, you know, at the whims of the market and doing the actual work, we wanted to marry the money that came in as much as possible to the people we cared most about, which was just the readers. Like, I would rather not spend my time worrying about if advertisers are mad at me. And honestly, once we get to a point, I would love to get sustainable to the point that we don't have to do grant writing anymore. And the philanthropic landscape is not what it used to be. And actually that's an outgrowth of George Floyd and the pandemic as well. So grant funders aren't asking for as much as they used to ask for in terms of like, oh, it has to be this and you have to do this and you have to do all this reporting and you have to prove to us that this thing we gave you money for, you're actually worthy of. So that's less of a problem, but still it's like every day I'm thinking about, or every hour I spend thinking about writing grants is an hour I don't get to think about doing the news. So right. That's really what we're trying to focus on is like, and so then, you know, over time, it's really just been a process of recognizing how the model of digital journalism is qualitatively different than specifically newspapers, but even TV news, where on a set schedule, whether it's nightly or a couple times a day or once a day in the case of a daily paper or once a week in the case of the Inlander, you have X number of pages to fill with X amount of content. And each of those sections, you know, you've got your news section, you've got your arts and culture, you've got your food section, you've got your art section, you've got your film section, just, you know, and then you've got your classifieds like the Inlander. Mm-hmm. You know, that meant you needed to do two or three I'm pulling this all from memory. You know, you're doing two or three food stories a week, two or three art stories a week, one and maybe two film stories a week, yada, yada, yada. And you have to fill that up every single time. And some percentage of people who read you are only reading you for the film reviews. So you always have to have film reviews. And people who are giving you money, advertisers who are giving you money, want to be in the film section. So you always have to fill the film section and on and on and on. And so I'm not kidding you. It took me 2 years of not being, and a decade removed from having left the Inlander, and then 2 years of doing a publication that has none of those constraints to realize we didn't have those constraints. And really it came from Carl on like his first 2 weeks on the job. We were just like, okay, what do we want to write about? Like, what's going on? What's in the bloodstream? And he was like, I think I want to just go check out Camp Hope. And just write, go talk to the people. And that's really, so, you know, we don't really have a lot of hard and fast missional rules, except that we try to start all of our reporting as close to the ground level as possible. Kind of like the Holacracy thing. It's like, we want to talk to the people most affected by whatever we're doing before we go talk to the people who are making policy around that stuff or make, you know, whatever the decision makers. So I was like, yeah, man, go talk and go see what's going on over there. Go talk to the people, figure out what they need. And he called me like 2 hours later. He's like, I think I need to come out here every day until this heat wave breaks and just write dispatches daily. And that like panicked me on a couple different levels. It was like, oh my God, are we just going to become the place that does nothing but, you know, housing related coverage, or does nothing but Camp Hope related coverage? And then the other thing was like, oh my God, we're going from like publishing once a week to publishing every single day. That's terrifying too. Are we going to be able to keep that up? And both of those were like fear responses that were, I think, probably understandable if I'm being kind to myself, but also completely unnecessary, because like that was actually really, I think, what launched the decision to just be like, yes, let's follow this wherever it needs to go. And with no real insight in mind, except just trying to tell the truest story that we could, let's just go with it and see where it takes us. And there's literally no harm in trying. And we don't have to fill up a film section and a culture section and a traditional news section. We just get to follow whatever stories feel most important at that moment. And I guess we'll figure out the rest of it later. and so I think that was actually really having the three of us thinking almost every day, or, you know, every day. And I have roles outside of range at the co-op. So I'm not like 100% focused on range every day, but I try to spend as much time in range as I can. And Carl, it's his only job. And Val is also a board member at the co-op. So she's like 90% range, 95% range, and she has other stuff. So it's this team of people who to do nothing but think about how, what range should look like for the foreseeable future really is still in, I don't want to say shaped because I think it's a process of becoming. We're shaping range sort of every day that we have time to think about it. So
That's awesome. We're going to take another quick break, but we'll be right back. Stick with us.
Hi, I'm Madeline, and I like dragonflies because I love different subjects that we get to explore. Tune in on Dragonflies on Thin Air every Sunday at 3 on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
So there's a writer that Ezekiel and I have both followed for a long time named Ben Thompson. He's a tech industry analyst, writes a little publication called Stratechery. And I remember several years ago, he was talking a lot about the local news ecosystem and how do we build something new. And his idea was more of a subscription-based news. But I think there was one interesting innovation that he thought of, which was, you know, in an ideal world, you wouldn't be advertising based like you were talking about. You wouldn't have this expectation of, I need to cover, you know, I need, X number of pages on this topic and this topic and this topic. You just cover whatever happened in any given week and or on any given day. And if there was a day when it's just like nothing happened, then you can just tell your readers, go about your day. Nothing happened in the city that's worth talking about. And that is kind of what your subscribers are paying for, is not for all of this, you know, broader content, is not for three pages on film every single week. It's just let them know what's going on in the community. And it seems like when you were talking about with Carl's coverage of Camp Hope, that you went there and you were like, this is what we need to cover. Yeah. You kind of had that freedom to just say, hey, let's get away from all of this, all the other constraints that we're used to in this business and just cover what we feel like we need to cover. And it seems like there's that starting piece of how do you rewire yourself and tell yourself as a reporter that you can do that. But then there's also the flip side of how do you convince readers that that's something worth paying for? That you kind of have this traditional mindset of, I'm used to paying for a paper that gets delivered every day. How do you connect with readers and say, hey, this is what you're paying for? And it may be a little bit more amorphous. It may be, it may not have this strict sense of there's a product that you're paying for, but that you're paying for the connection to the community. And you're paying, I think Ben Thompson kind of used the framing of, you're paying for the future production of content rather than for the thing that's in your hand.
Yeah. To be honest, that's something I really worried about a lot in the early going, was making that case. And I actually think that the case kind of makes itself. I don't think you, and we'll see how far that goes. You know, we have about 400 members now. I think we need about 700 per staff person, you know, so we need like sustainability for the current team looks like 2,100 members. So we might come up against some sort of hard limit where the people who are just like, we love you, we're in for whatever, we might hit a hard limit on that. We haven't come even close yet. I don't even know that I've ever had somebody cancel because they said, you guys don't post enough. That might not be true, but it's like less than one hand's worth of people. It's less than five people. We have a lot of people who are like, oh, I've had something come up in my life. You know, the cost of daycare came up. I can't support you anymore, but I want to be back as soon as I can, or I'm just going to donate whenever I have extra money. Which is actually one of the missional things that we're trying to do. And we think we're going to get there with the sort of like, you know, closest to the problem, reporting focus, is like, we're doing kind of an NPR model where we're not going to have paywalls, because part of like, if we have anything close to a mission statement, it really is bringing as many people into news awareness and information access as we possibly can, which does not create the cleanest, like, oh, here's the profit motive and here's the profit. Like, here's the profit incentive is finding this exact group of people and then getting as many people, as many of them as possible to pay for the service. But it's what I feel like we need to do in order to make Spokane a place that more strongly represents the people that actually live here. Like, you know, the people, if the only people that show up to public to yell at our public officials at public meetings are the people that can afford to do that, or the people that can afford to spend time figuring out who's making what decisions in what public meeting every day, then we're gonna get decisions made on behalf of people who have a lot of free time and a lot of leisure on their hands. And that's those, you know, it will not surprise you that those are the people who have always run this town. And so what we're trying to do is not necessarily change Spokane through anything we do directly. Although I would say advocacy journalism has gotten some stuff changed. Like, our journalism has gotten stuff changed outside of a mass movement demanding it. But it's about empowering folks who have been like, I don't even know, this is too complex of a system. I don't even know who can help me with this problem. I don't even know who to yell at because something, my kid got sent to a different school, or, you know, there's stuff happening in my neighborhood that I'm not cool with, or whatever. We're trying to provide that information to all of us and then help tell those stories so that it humanizes people that are at the margins for the general readership, but also really empowers those people to create their own cohorts of power building, or at least kind of help people sort of find each other. You know, if, you know, there's a lot of stuff around public school, you know, like the CRT stuff that's happening in public schools, like letting people know that's happening, where it's happening, when it's happening, so they can go make their voices heard and stuff like that.
How do you, so this is generational warfare. We should loop in some generational component here. And the one thing that comes to mind is, I mean, you talked about how this is, this model and, this kind of coverage is intuitive to people, that it's like, hey, this is obviously what's valuable, for local news. But I wonder if there is maybe some generational difference in terms of for whom it's intuitive and maybe for whom it's a little bit less intuitive. Do you see in kind of your readership or your subscribers, kind of younger people especially gravitating towards this and being like, oh yeah, this makes total sense, that like this is where I'd want to give my local news dollars to? Or do you feel like it's pretty much across generational lines, like everybody's gravitating towards it kind of equally? And then also as a part of that, kind of access to your coverage. Do you feel like everybody has the means to see it and follow?
Yeah. I think the answer to that is, I don't know yet. I think there's a lot of variables to play there. And one of which is being the platforms that, you know, we're all on. Like, Spokane's not a huge Twitter town. We're still more of a Facebook town. So when we do Facebook ads, the people who sign up are grandparents because that's, and Twitter advertising doesn't work very well here. So that's more of an organic play. And so, and you know, each of these platforms, and Twitter more every day since Elon took over, is like trying to monetize what before was, more of an organic engagement thing. So we're actually trying to, through the newsletter and through just people voluntarily giving us their emails, like part of what we're trying to do is just break free to the extent that we can from dependence on these platforms that don't actually care about us. They don't care about any of us. And they certainly don't care about, like, if you built your business marketing to people through Facebook for free, which is literally how the success of Terrain as an arts organization for the first close to 10 years, at least 8 years, was almost entirely due to organic reach on Facebook, specifically a little bit of Instagram, but mostly Facebook. That has completely gone away. So that's a little bit of digression, but it sort of gives you a sense of how hard it is to know. Like, I would assume that our readership is going to be younger, although that's not necessarily the people who are going to be able to afford to pay for it. Right. So we sort of have a split readership where I think the people who are currently paying for Range are the people who are paying for other kinds of news. And I think that's okay. Because the people, if people who can't afford to pay for it now still get access to it and we can still find a sustainable path forward, then I think that's good. And the people that, at least so far, because we are going to test some sponsorships and stuff like that. It's not going to be traditional advertising, and it's not going to be come one, come all. We're going to develop some policies around, like, not just anybody can advertise on or sponsor a post on Range, because we feel like we've created this really deep trust with people. And that actually, we've even done just a few test things like, you know, hey, you should come to this thing that's happening at Golden Handle, the brewery that the co-op owns, or you should apply for this job that the agency has available. And the click-through rates are crazy on those compared to other stuff that I've seen in digital media from back when I was doing advertising work. And so that's not exactly the question you asked, but I think like what we're doing, at least so far, and part of that also comes back to Val's job isn't just like getting as many people to sign up for the newsletter as possible. Like we go out in the community, we have, you know, beer or coffee sessions at the coffee shops and breweries and stuff, just to like let people come and talk about the things that they're worried or concerned about or curious about, things they like about what Range does and what we don't like about what Range does. And that's created a lot of loyalty. We're really active on Reddit. Spokane subreddit is a surprisingly untoxic place given social media at large and Reddit specifically. Like it's a really well sort of organized community of people who don't put up with too much BS. And, but they also, it's the most robust platform I know of for like actual substantive debate in Spokane, way better than Facebook. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think generally speaking, it's a mix of, you know, upwardly mobile, probably young boomers and Gen Xers and maybe old millennials like me, on the paying member side. And I think it's a lot of young people who are maybe a little bit downwardly mobile, maybe a little bit more educated than you would expect for where they're at in their lives economically, which is what we're seeing of both millennials and Gen Z, who are trying to find ways to engage and actually make change or just at least understand what's going on in Spokane in a way that resonates with their lived experience. Mm-hmm.
There seems to be an interesting trend of, you know, in the past it was you had a certain amount that you would pay for the paper and that was what it was. And every once in a while you'd probably negotiate it down. You'd be like, "Ooh, it got too high. Let me call the, you know, reconsideration line or whatever and say, "Hey, I need to bring this down." But that was kind of always the thinking was it's just like you have a fixed amount that you pay for the paper and if anything you try and bring down how much you're paying for it. Yeah. And Substack and some of these new platforms seem to put a little bit more emphasis on, you know, here's the baseline of how much you can pay. But if you really value this, pay more, you know, become, you know, a super donor, become a whatever, you know, there's a range. I think Range itself has a, you know, not just, you know, you can start with $10 a month, but you can go up as much as you want to. And it seems like that change of the framing really liberates people to decide for themselves how much they value it and to be a lot more generous sometimes than they might think they would be able to be.
Yeah, we added those two. So we started with a $10 tier and that was the way we were aware for 2 years. And then right before the holiday season this year, when we were doing our end of year campaign, we just were like, okay, why don't we just do what 25 and 50? Does that make sense? And I think that's the other, like there's the perfectionist piece of me that I think is probably innate to me, but then also comes out in when you have to make sure a paper, a print product is as perfect as it can be before you send it to a printer. You have to pay really close attention and agonize over details before you ever ship something. Part of what I think digital news on the business side is helping us think through is like, yeah, just try it. What's the worst thing that could happen? Somebody doesn't give you $50 a month. What's the best thing that could happen? A couple of people do. And that's the equivalent of like five people, five normal members. And then all of a sudden it gets a lot more, if people want to sort of scratch maybe more of a philanthropic itch or something, it's like, wow, like that person is then helping basically pay for four other people who can't afford to pay for the platform. That's potentially pretty powerful. And, you know, so yeah, we've got like, we have about 5 or 6 members, but that's still kind of more than I thought we were going to have at the $50 tier, to be honest. And we've got a decent number. I think we've got about 10-ish or 20-ish, $25 a month people. And that's awesome. I love that. And at no point, and part of the whole thing, like thinking back to like using the NPR as a model or public television as a model, it was like, oh, do we need to give them swag? Do we need to give them a Range mug? Do we need to give them a shirt? And that like starts to be really pretty like anxiety inducing. So they're like, okay, well then how are we going to fulfillment? And we're going to have to buy boxes or bags or whatever. And I was just like, why don't we just see if people want to just give us the money? Cause that's how much they value the thing we're doing. And we can think about giving people, bonus swag later. And actually that puts me in a place where I'm like, I feel so much gratitude. Like I want to go above and beyond for people rather than feeling like, oh, I set up this value proposition where it's like for $50 a month, you get our content and you get a mug or a t-shirt or something. Mm-hmm. It just feels like a lot better to me. So, and people seem to like it. So yeah, you're right about that. I think it's a pretty interesting model that I don't, for whatever reason, a lot of legacy media, even as they pivot to digital, don't seem to be really thinking much about. So it definitely is kind of a new media way of thinking about, well, it's membership instead of subscription. So specifically that's what it's called.
Yeah. So with that said, how can people become a member of Range? How can they support your work? And also just how can they follow you and your work?
You can go to rangemedia.co, not com, co. Range is not the most unique name for a media outlet, it turns out. It was impossible to get the .com, but rangemedia.co. And then it'll ask you to sign up for a newsletter pretty quickly. And then you can click the membership bar in the top right-hand corner. We've got a tip jar. You can leave tips too. Any of those ways work.
Mm-hmm. And how about following you in particular?
I'm at Luke Baumgarten on Twitter, and we're Range Media for All on Twitter. And then you can just search for us on Facebook. So we're on Facebook, Instagram, and in Twitter.
Sweet. Well, thank you so much, Luke, for coming on the show. We really appreciate you coming on and all the service that you've done for our community, all the amazing coverage. Keep it up.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Thanks, Zeke. Mm-hmm.